Hi, welcome to Webcamps TV. I'm your host, Brady Gaster, and today we are here with Rowan Miller. He is a PM on the Entity Framework team, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about Entity Framework. I think you've probably seen Rowan on Robert's show a couple times.
That's correct, yeah.
Talking about EF, but today he's going to talk about EF in the context of an MVC application, so that's exciting for us. So let's go ahead and get started. What's new in the land of EF? I hear there's some new advancements in the designer and all over the place.
Yeah, thanks, Brady. So we're getting ready to release EF5 at the moment. And so what I thought I'd start by doing is just giving like a brief history of the versions we've got, because people get a little bit confused sometimes. We've had a lot of versions recently. Kind of talk about what we've had and then talk about EF5, what's coming new in EF5 and where it fits in the stack. Sound all right?
Fantastic.
Cool. So historically, EF started by shipping as part of Visual Studio and part of the .NET framework. Mm-hmm. We found this was a little bit slow-moving for us. People were asking for features, and we had to wait for the next version of these products to release before we could get those in customers' hands. So we released two versions as part of Visual Studio and .NET Framework. Then we started shipping out of band. And to do that, we released on NuGet, which is a nice, easy way to pull new products into your project as needed.
Nice.
We released EF 4.1, 4.2, and 4.3 this way. People often ask about the weird versions. We started with EF, presumably one, it didn't really have a version number, and then we skipped straight to four. That's because we were shipping as part of the .NET framework, we were matching with the framework versions.
Makes sense.
Now that we've broken from the framework, we decided to adopt semantic versioning, which is pretty popular outside of Microsoft, and quite a few teams at Microsoft are starting to adopt semantic versioning.
What exactly, how would you define semantic versioning?
So you can go to semver.org, and it gives a nice definition, but basically the way it works, you have a major version, a minor version, and a patch. Which in this case, four is the major, one is the minor, and then if you release patches or bug fixes.
Gotcha.
Patches are just bug fixes, minor versions are non-breaking changes, major versions get revved when you have major new features or you make a breaking change in your product.
Good to know.
So 4.1, we introduced two main new things. One was the DB context API. People were telling us EF was way too complicated, we needed a simpler API surface. So we did that, we introduced a new DB context type. Folks were also telling us they wanted an option that didn't involve working in the designer. They just wanted to write code, so we also introduced the code-first workflow. 4.2 was basically just bug fixes, and 4.3 we introduced migrations, which we'll see in the demo today.
Right.
Those last three features, like I said, released on NuGet instead of inside Visual Studio. So that brings us to EF5. Obviously, lots of new features, so we bumped the major version. Some of the new features, and I'm going to demo some of these today, we have enums, which people have been crying out for since we first introduced EF. Mm-hmm. Spatial data, like geography and geometry data types, which have been in SQL Server for quite a while now.
Exciting.
Some pretty significant performance improvements. In some of our end-to-end applications we're running, we're seeing a 67% performance improvement just by adopting EF5, which is pretty significant.
Yes, it is.
Table-valued functions. This is a feature that's supported in the database. At the moment, this is only supported in the database first workflow, but you'll see it come online in code first a bit later on.
Cool.
We've also made some improvements to the designer. So people have been asking to be able to split a big model up into multiple diagrams within the designer. So that's coming in Visual Studio 11, along with being able to batch import store procedures. This was just a bit of a rough edge. If you had a lot of store procedures in your database, you had to repeat the same steps multiple times.
Right.
So that's all I've got for versions.
Okay. I think we've seen a little bit of code-first migrations in a previous show with Scott Hunter.
Correct.
That's really what got me excited about it, and I think Syed showed us some stuff as well with that. So I'm really excited to find out what's going on with 5.
Yeah.
I'd love to learn more about the spatial data types.
Cool. They're in the demo, so we'll get to see them today.
Excellent. Let's go crazy.
So one of the questions a lot of people has, these last 4.1, 4.2, 4.3 have been more focused on code first than the designer.
Right.
You could use DB context with the designer.
Right.
Wasn't really first class, and we were very, very focused on, obviously, the migrations feature, which is only code first.
Okay.
The designer's not dead.
Good.
So
good.
We're still working on features for that. It's still a very much first class option for people who want it.
That's good to hear.
So that brings us to, which one do I use? Like, how do I decide? I've heard model first, database first, code first. Boils down to two fundamental questions. And the first one is something you don't really have control over, and that is your application targeting a new database or an existing database? The second question is completely up to you and your team. And that is, do I prefer to draw boxes and lines in a designer? Or am I a team that prefers to just write code? I don't want a designer at all. So let's fill in some of the boxes. Designer-centric to a new database, that's model first. So you open up the designer, which creates an EDMX file for you. You draw your boxes and lines, and then you ask the designer to generate a database schema to match the boxes and lines that you drew.
Fantastic.
Database first is our oldest workflow. That's been around for quite a while now. In this one, you have an existing database. You point the designer at it, and it reverse engineers the boxes and lines from the database.
Gotcha.
Once that's done, you can start to tweak the model in the designer. In both model first and database first, you don't actually write your classes. They're generated for you based on the EDMX file.
Okay.
So that brings us to code-centric now. Code-centric to a new database is code first. And this is what people automatically think of when we talk about code first. I write some classes, I can write some extra code to change a bit what the database looks like, and then my database is actually generated for me.
Right.
This last box is one that we didn't do a very good job of messaging. And in fact, the name code first doesn't really mesh very well with this, so people sometimes call this code second.
Interesting.
This is, I have an existing database. What we've had from the start, you could write classes and write mapping to map to that existing database.
Okay.
We've also released the EF Power Tools. So if you have a big database, say 50, 100, 200 tables, that's going to be a lot of code to write up front.
Right.
So with the EF Power Tools, you can point them at the existing database, and they'll actually generate a whole bunch of code first code for you.
Nice.
So starting point, once it's generated, you can go through and tweak the classes, tweak the mapping to look like you want them to.
So it's almost like the EDMX files that get generated when you point them at a database and reverse engineer. But instead of reverse engineering to an EDMX file, you're reverse engineering into code. And then you can use your code and tweak however you want to.
That's exactly it. And it's a good way to think about it. There's basically two ways of representing a model
right.
in Entity Framework. One is using EDMX and one is using code.
Okay.
Once you hit the runtime, it doesn't matter how you generated the model in the designer or in code. They behave exactly the same when you hit the runtime. Same API surface, everything.
Cool. Is the, just a curiosity, is the code that sits behind the EDMX files the kind of the same code that you would go with if you wrote code first?
No, it's
not.
Or is
it variant?
It's varying a little bit. So the classes that you actually interact with, so say you have a blog table in your database, you're probably going to have a blog class.
Mm-hmm.
That class will look pretty similar, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's different is in code first, the mapping. So say you have a name property on the blog which maps to a blog underscore name column in the database.
Gotcha, okay.
In the EDMX, that mapping is going to be represented in XML.
Okay.
In code first, that mapping is going to be represented in code.
Gotcha. Cool. Okay. Makes sense. Good to know.
So one point that I didn't call out on the previous slide, we've had inside Visual Studio on the .NET framework, then we've had out-of-band on NuGet.
Mm-hmm.
EF5 is actually going to be both. So it is an out-of-band release that will be available on NuGet, but it's also going to pop up in a lot of places in Visual Studio 11.
Excellent.
Some of those places will be the MVC project template, the Web API project template, or if you create a new model using the designer, we'll actually pull in the NuGet package for you as well.
Fantastic.
So you get the mix of out of band, we can update frequently, but if you're someone who just wants to get Visual Studio 11 and use what comes in the box, you'll also get EF5.
Cool, good to know. So I think that's similar to what the ASP.NET team is doing. They're just like putting everything in NuGet and pulling it down as needed.
Very simple.
Which is good, which is a good thing.
The designer at the moment is still very much tied to Visual Studio,
mm-hmm.
so the updates to the designer will come as part of Visual Studio 11,
mm-hmm.
but we are working to make the designer out of band as well.
Oh, interesting.
But it will continue to also ship in Visual Studio as well.
Fantastic. Cool.
That's it for slides. Let's drop out to some demos.
That's what we want to see.
All right, so what I've got here is Visual Studio 11 beta. Mm-hmm. I wanted to use bits that are publicly available at the moment, so everything you're seeing you can download and do yourself today.
Good to know.
All I've done is go ahead and create a blank MVC application. And I just did that ahead of time because in beta, it takes a while to create a new MVC up.
Right.
That is an improved performance in the next release of Visual Studio.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to start by creating a model. And I thought I'd demo code first. All the features that I'm going to demo are also available in the designer, apart from migrations.
Okay.
So let's go ahead and add a model. So I'm going to add a new class. We'll call this a model. And I'm going to start by just defining some classes that are going to make up our model. So we're going to work with a store and a products. So you can see here we have a store class. It has an ID and a name. A store also has a list of products that it sells that have prices. Stores also belong to a category, and category I've defined here as an enum. We have food, drink, books, hardware. We could add to this enum as well.
Which is new.
It is new.
Cool.
Previously, versions of EF and Code First, this enum property would have just got ignored and it wouldn't be persisted to the database. What we're going to see in a minute is we'll get a column created in the database for us. So far, we haven't used Entity Framework. But now it's time to define a context, and a context just represents a session with a database.
Okay.
Now, in VS 11 beta, the MVC project template came with EF 4.1 still. In the next release, it's actually going to come with EF 5. But for the moment, we're just going to upgrade. So I'm just going to type in update package, tell it to update the Entity Framework package. Now, the final release of EF5 isn't available on NuGet yet. We still have the release candidate, which means to get it, I need to pass this dash pre, or the long version of that is dash include pre-release,
gotcha.
Which just means we're going to get the release candidate version. Although it's a pre-release version, it does have a go-live license on it. So you can pick up EF5 RC and use it in a production application today.
Good to know.
Okay, so with EF installed, we can go ahead and create the context. And again, I'm going to keep using code snippets here because you don't want to watch me type all this stuff out.
Sure.
But you'll see the code that I'm writing is pretty simple. So we create our context. You guys have seen this before. It derives from a DB context, and we expose a set for each type in our model.
Okay.
Nothing new there. So I'm going to go ahead and build. And then we're not really going to focus on MVC, but I'm just going to scaffold out a controller for our stores just so we can see our data access in action. So we're going to use the store class, and we're going to use our existing sales context. One of the cool things here, I think you saw this in Scott's demo, is that MVC will actually create a context for you too if you don't have one.
Nice.
So
okay.
You don't have to write the context code out yet.
But if you're a control freak, you can just do it yourself.
Yeah, if you're like me and you like all your classes to look neat and tidy.
Right.
All right, so that's just going to chug. It's looking at the model, generating views and controller for you.
Cool.
We'll give that a second to work. To start with, we're just going to run the app. We're going to use the default code that it's scaffolded into the controller. And then we're going to come back a bit later and look at modifying some of that code.
Excellent.
So the action that we're going to hit on the controller is this index. As you can see, it's just hitting the stores property on our context and returning all of the stores. There's two things I'm going to do before we actually run this app. And they're both in global.asax. One is I'm going to set the stores controller as the default. So stop me having to type whack stores into the URL bar all the time. The other thing I'm going to do in MVC 4, Dev 11, we introduced this new thing called LocalDB. So we took SQL Express out of Visual Studio and we put LocalDB on. Code First by default works with SQL Express.
Mm-hmm.
So what the MVC guys did is add this little bit of code which will tell Code First to use LocalDB by default instead.
Gotcha.
Now, unfortunately, there's actually a bug in this line of code, which is a little bit embarrassing, but we missed out a slash in LocalDB.
Right.
So we need to take out this line of code. The good thing is, when we installed EF5, Code First actually worked out that I'm using Dev 11, SQL Express isn't available. I have LocalDB on the box. So it puts some settings in my config file to say, for this application, use LocalDB by default.
Okay.
All right, so let's go ahead and run.
And I assume that that particular bug will be worked out by RC.
It's fixed in RC.
Yeah, okay, cool,
yep.
Good.
Yep. And it's fixed mainly because in RC you get EF5. So when you create the project template, it installs Entity Framework, which detects whether you have SQL Express or LocalDB,
gotcha.
And puts the appropriate settings in place
gotcha.
For you.
So if that bug's bitten you, just be patient. It'll go away soon.
Yeah. Update to EF5 and delete that line of code.
That'll work.
Yeah. So we'll just give this a second to warm up. The reason it's taking a while to warm up, we don't have a database yet. So Code First is going out and creating the database. This is the first time we've used LocalDB on this machine in a little while, so it's actually firing up LocalDB.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
But, I mean, all that work is being done for you automatically.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's probably going to take it less time than it would you, right?
I can never remember how to create tables in SQL Server.
Right, exactly.
All right, so nothing new here. We're just going to go ahead and hit the Create New button just so we can see this in action. We'll create a store called Seattle Sales.
Perfect.
Go ahead and create. We can see our website's working. So let's just go ahead and take a quick look at the database it created for us. So in Server Explorer, I'm just going to connect to LocalDB. We'll find the databases. You can see The database is named after the fully qualified name of our context. Lots of ways to change that in CodeFirst.
Right.
If you want to call it something else, we won't cover them here, but you can find them on our website, which I'll show you at the end.
I actually kind of like that.
Just avoids conflicts. If you're doing a lot of demos or you're doing prototyping, if we use a fully qualified name, you tend to reduce conflicts.
Right.
All right, so as expected, there's a stores and products table, the products, enum property, category. If we look at that, we'll see it's of data type integer, as expected. So the enum is an integer, so it just stores it as an integer in the database.
And if you were to add enum values, there's not going to be any conflicts. It's going to continue to
Continue up. We don't actually create a table for the enum. So the enum is literally just an integer column. And we do the translation, obviously, to and from the enum as we save data to the database and query it back for you.
Do you have any recommendations for people that would want to have a separate table there, for the people that want to have a lookup table?
So that's actually interesting. So there's no way to model that actually in Entity Framework.
Okay.
But we're going to look at migrations in a second.
Okay.
And migrations now actually allows you to have a bit more control over the database.
Cool.
So if you want to add columns, you want to add tables, you want to insert extra data, you can actually do that inside migrations now.
Okay.
So that's a nice segue. Let's jump straight into migrations. Cool. So I'm going to load up our model again. And I'm just going to make a really simple change, something you've seen before, so that we don't confuse. We'll look at just migrations on its own. So let's go ahead and say we want to store a phone number for the stores. And let's say we probably want a maximum length of, say, 20 characters for this.
That's fair.
So we'll do max length. Just resolve the namespace on that one. So folks have probably seen this before, but by default, CodeFirst creates an nvarchar max column for string properties.
Mm-hmm.
You can change that. You can put attributes on. If you don't want attributes in your classes, we have the thing called the Fluent API where you can register these. So you have quite a bit of control over what the database looks like.
Cool. So attributes or Fluent?
Yep.
Either way. Cool.
Attributes are simpler. If you're like me, I don't really like putting attributes in my classes. Mm-hmm. I like them to be super simple.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to prefer the Fluent API.
Cool.
Let's hit F5. And what we'll see here is we're going to get an exception. Because CodeFirst has said, hey, you created the database when your model looked like A, your model now looks like B and doesn't match the database anymore.
Yeah, there we go.
Now, in the past, this error would have said you need to drop and recreate your database, which is a horrible solution to that problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now it's telling you to go and look at CodeFirst migrations, and we give you a little link there to go and learn about migrations.
Excellent.
I kind of know how to use it, so we probably won't go to the link. So I'm going to go and do enable migrations. So this is going to set up migrations to work with our project.
Oh.
Now, I only have one context, so migrations can do a bit of work to figure out that I have one context, I have an existing database, it's going to work all that out for me. It's gone and scaffolded a couple of things for me. Just give us a little bit more room on the screen here. So in the migrations folder, we see we have a configuration class.
Mm-hmm.
This is the configuration for migrations. So we'll see in a second that there's a whole bunch of settings in there for migrations.
Okay.
The other thing it's done is created this initial create migration for us. Now, we'll come back to this in a second because it'll make a little bit more sense. Let's just look at the configuration. So we'll see this is a class that basically says it's the migrations configuration for our sales context. And then there's a whole bunch of settings in here, some things like automatic migrations. We don't have time to demo that today, but if you don't want to have code for all the migrations that you do, you can actually have it automatic. You can register providers, say you're targeting a MySQL or an Oracle database. You can register a third-party migrations provider in here.
Excellent. Okay.
Cool.
Okay.
Whole bunch of things you can do in here.
Right.
The other thing that we'll see in a minute is there's this opportunity to express some seed data that should be put in the database. We'll see that in action in a minute.
That's cool.
We've made a change to our model. Remember, we added the phone property.
Mm-hmm.
So we can use the add migration command. And we get to give these things a name. So we're just going to call this, we added the phone.
It's sort of like just a log, whatever that particular migration change was.
Yeah, so we'll see it when it pops up. So this is nothing revolutionary. Expressing migrations in terms of code has been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The idea of having a timestamped set of sequences that is some code that get converted into SQL and run against the database, that's a pretty well-accepted way of doing migrations.
I agree.
What is a little bit new is that we scaffold them for you. So CodeFirst, you already have a model. You've already made some changes. It'd be silly to have to retype those changes again in terms of the database.
Mm-hmm.
So what migrations does is it basically stores a snapshot of what the model looked like when you generated the last migration. It then looks at what the model looks like now, and in our case it said, oh, you added a phone property. That means you want a phone column in the database.
Right.
So it scaffolded a migration to do that for us. You can see it's a pretty simple little API here. We add a column to the stores table called phone. It's of type string, has a max length of 20.
Fantastic.
Now, the cool thing here is I can edit this. I could choose to, say, index this. So I could add a create index call after this and a drop index call.
Nice.
I could add default values. I can do a whole bunch of things in here. So this is nice because it allows my database schema to drift a little bit from what's expressible in code first.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, you can go the other way with down, of course.
Yes. Like, so we have up and down, and we'll actually see that. You can migrate up and down through these steps.
Wonderful.
All right. So with the migration done, the other command we want is update database. So what update database does is it's going to say, I have XYZ migrations in my project. XY have been applied to the database, which means we need to take migration Z and apply it to the database. Now, in our case, we already had an existing schema, right? So what migrations has done is it's actually scaffolded a migration that kind of expresses what happened that first time we pressed F5.
Right.
In fact, it expresses exactly what happened.
Right.
So we created the stores and products table. The stores had a store ID and a name, but it didn't have the phone number one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's scaffolded this migration. It's also updated the database to make it look like this migration has already been run, because it has when we pressed F5.
Cool.
So when we pressed update database, it looked at the database and saw that the initial create migration had already been run. So it skips that one, sees that we have this add phone number. That hasn't been run, so it goes ahead and runs it. So now our database has the phone number column. Press F5, we'll see that everything runs.
Wow.
Now, obviously, I didn't re-scaffold the controller, so our phone number is not exposed on the UI yet.
But right.
We'll see that we no longer get the exception, and everything's happy.
Wonderful.
All right, so let's go and look at some seed data. So in the configuration class, I have this seed method.
Mm-hmm.
There's some comments here explaining how to use the seed method. One of the things we did in migrations is we added this extension method called add or update. So I can go to stores and I can say add or update. What you'll see is it's asking me for a list of stores to store in the database. Now I can give it a list of stores. What it's going to do is actually match those stores by primary key.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to say, you've given me a store that has ID 1.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't one in the database, so I'm going to create it for you. You gave me one that has ID 2. There is one in the database, so I'm going to update the one in the database with the values from the one you gave me.
That's pretty smart.
Our primary keys are store generated, though. So we don't necessarily know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
They could change,
mm-hmm.
you know, over time. So what we're actually going to do is give it something else to match on. So we're going to say, I'm going to give you some data, but instead of matching on primary key, I want you to match on the name property.
Awesome.
And then you don't want to watch me type this out, so I'm going to drag in. Here's some I created earlier. Three stores. Now, what's interesting here, Seattle Sales is actually the name of the store that we already created.
Mm-hmm.
Just resolving namespaces here. These two aren't in our database yet. So let's go ahead and hit update database. We'll see update database sees that there's no migrations to apply, but it's going to run our seed method.
Mm-hmm.
So now if we go ahead and hit F5, what we'll hopefully see so we'll run our application. That looks better. I'm not sure what I hit there.
Cool.
And on the index page, we'll see those three stores listed out.
Cool.
There we go.
Excellent.
Cool.
Excellent.
All right, so you asked about spatial data. You
mm-hmm.
wanted to see that before.
Yes.
So it'd be good if the stores had a location, like a GPS coordinate.
Right.
Then we could do some fancy maths, work out the store closest to people, all those sorts of things.
Nice.
So let's go back to the model. And let's actually add a property for the location. So the data type we want is DB geography, not DB context. Just going to resolve that. It's in the system data spatial namespace. And we're going to call this location. Now, DB geography at the moment is inside .NET framework in the entity framework assemblies. So this one doesn't ship out of band, which is good. It means it can be reused across multiple products.
Excellent, excellent.
Cool. So now that we've got, sorry.
I was just going to ask, that's specific to the SQL Server spatial data type. Does it kind of map up there? Or
No, so this is actually a high-level abstraction. So providers would need to implement this to be able to use it with their spatial data types.
Okay.
So at the moment, it's probably just the SQL Server provider that actually supports it, but it is there and other providers can support it too.
Good to know.
Yep. So we need to add a migration, obviously, and we're just going to say that we added the location. Nothing surprising here. The migration's just going to say, add one column called location, which is of type geography.
I really like that.
Cool. Let's update our seed data too. Okay. Let's take this out. And another, here's one we prepared earlier. All I'm adding is, let's just format things a little better here. Just resolve some namespaces. Bumped my font size up to present, and now it's not all fitting on the screen.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We've got the three stores we had before. Again, it's going to match on the name. This time it's going to see that we specified a location, and that location doesn't match what's already in the database. So when the seed method runs, it's going to go ahead and update that column in the database.
Fantastic.
And we'll see here, I'm just passing in some GPS coordinates that I took off Bing Maps. So let's go ahead and run update database.
And that's going to reseed everything.
Yep, so it's going to do two things. One is going to run our migration to add the location column.
Right.
Then it's going to run the seed method, which will populate that column.
Fantastic.
Cool. So let's actually use this. Let's go to the stores controller. And I have a little snippet here, which gives us a GPS coordinate for my office. This might be a dangerous thing to put out on the internet.
Probably. Yeah. Probably.
That's where you'll find my office. So then let's write a link query. So we're going to say the stores. And this is just link. But let's do an order by s dot location. And let's find how far the location is from my office. Look, all right?
That's fantastic. I actually wrote an application recently, got a typo there. Wrote an application recently where I do a triangulation against a list of zip codes,
mm-hmm.
and it's hundreds of lines of code. This is really slick.
Yeah, so what you'll see here is a nice API over the top of them all.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Congratulations on that. It's really cool.
All right, so let's run this. We'll actually notice when I run this that the order of the stores changes a little bit.
Right.
The Seattle one's still obviously closest to my office, but
right.
We'll see the two New York ones flip around when the page loads up. So as expected, we see the distance from my office.
Awesome.
Cool. All right, so we've been showing migrations. A lot of people are like, this is cool. There is no way my DBA is going to let me run migrations against a production database, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we might get to this stage. We've finished our app. We talk to our DBA, and he's like, dude, I need a SQL script. There is no way you're hooking that up to
right.
a production server. So
right.
one of the good things we can do is the update database command, we can pass the dash script option. Now, at the moment, we're using a local database, and our code and our database are in sync, right? So there's actually no pending migrations. But the other thing I can do is specify the migrations that I want to script between. So I can say the source migration is, and I could pick any point in those list of three migrations I have, but given this is the first time we'd be deploying the app, we actually want the empty database, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we want to go from an initial database, and that's just a static variable that we've
right.
got there that you can use.
A convention, sort of.
And target migration, and I can pick the name of any of these, and I don't have to specify the timestamp. I don't want to have to type this big number out. So we want to go to the latest one, which was add location, like that. Hit enter, and it's going to chug away for a minute. And when it's done, it's going to give me a SQL script.
Wow.
That would represent taking those migrations and applying them in order. And of course, if my DBA, maybe he doesn't like the way I name indexes, things like that, you can go ahead and edit the script. The other option, if your DBA doesn't like the way you name indexes, is to actually edit the migrations and change the index name. We'll generate things like this by default, like primary key names, foreign key names, index names, all those things, but you're free to change them in the migrations too.
Excellent. So usually you could sit down with your DBA, go through all the migrations and make sure
mm-hmm.
that you've got everything kosher with their roles,
yep.
and then it'll generate whatever they need.
So the other cool thing is the code generators we have are actually customizable. So in here, you'll see there's a code generator property there, which you can actually set. And you can derive from our code generators and tweak the little bits you want. So if you wanted to change the code that's generated for an index and use the naming convention that your DBA says you need to use,
mm-hmm.
then you're free to do that. And that saves you having to edit every migration after you've generated it.
Excellent.
So we tried to make things as extensible as possible. The other one that was in there was the SQL generator. So you can actually customize the SQL that gets generated too.
Like change the indentation or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. So there's some examples we've got out there. You can do things, a whole bunch of things on here, like maybe you want to be able to create descending indexes. Now, right. Descending indexes aren't natively supported in the API, mm-hmm. but we kind of have this property bag where you can lump extra values in the API, and then you can customize the SQL generator to actually take advantage of those.
Cool.
We tried to make everything as extensible as possible. Obviously, there's not enough time to demo all that now, but
right.
It's there if you need it.
One thing I'm wondering about, do you guys have a cheat sheet for all the command line commands? That would be really, really helpful. Probably staple that to my wall.
So you can type, we just scroll up, we'll see after we installed.
Get help EF or...
That's in there. Get help entity framework is the one you want. So you can type that, it'll show you everything you're after.
Nice.
Which is cool. Oh. There's really only two commands at the moment, which, mm-hmm. well, there's three enable migrations, which you use once. Mm-hmm. Once you've done that, it's just add migration and update database. And you basically toggle backwards and forwards between those two.
It's pretty easy.
Now, you asked about down before. So we can also do update database and target migration. And let's roll back to add phone number. And I'm also going to pass the dash verbose flag here. That just allows us to see a little bit more information about what migrations is doing. We'll see it runs, and we've basically got some code there to drop the column for the location, if that makes sense.
Awesome.
Cool.
But then you have to go back through and modify the rest of your... Would you have to go back through and modify the MVC code?
Yeah. Okay. So where up and down is useful is if I want to edit the migration. So say I added the location, now I decide I want to index it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have an index there, so I could add a migration that has the create index and the drop index.
Okay.
But really, I want that to be part of the migration that added the location column, right?
True,
so
true.
What I would do is roll back, edit the migration, and then roll forwards again, and it comes, picks up the new migration, picks up the
Makes
changes
sense.
To that migration.
Makes so sense. That's fantastic.
It's good, too, for debugging to be able to roll up and down. Now, obviously, you can script out downgrades, too. So say you want to, you're pushing out from V2 to V3 upgrade. You can pre-script a migration to go from V3 back down to V2, give that to your DBA as a rollback script if something goes wrong with the upgrade and you need to roll the database back.
Fantastic.
All right, so before I mentioned the EF Power Tools, and one of the features I mentioned in that was the ability to point to an existing database and reverse engineer code first classes from that.
Right.
The Power Tools actually give us some other interesting things too. Now, in code first, people choose that because they like to work with code.
Right.
But every now and then, it's nice to be able to see a boxes and lines diagram of mm-hmm. what the model looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Power Tools, if I right-click on a class file that has a DB context defined in it, this is where our sales context is defined, I have this option to view entity data model. What this is going to do is load up a read-only view of our model in the designer. So this is good for being able to debug and see what code first is doing.
Okay. Or if you wanted to document your system, you could do it like this.
Yeah,
take
that's true, too.
Of this.
Yeah. The other option that a lot of people like, depending on what you want. So the designer will show you mapping as well. Mm-hmm. So you could look at the mapping for this. You could see that the name, property, and the products class maps to this column in the database.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. If you just want to see the model visually, then a lot of folks just stick with the object model. Okay, so you can create a new class diagram,
Right. Drop
your object model in, and then you get the boxes and lines using the class diagram view.
But you can't actually make any changes if you've started with code first and gone this way.
This is read-only. You can't edit it here. It will actually let you edit it, so you could change something here, but you know it doesn't go back the other way. So.
Okay,
so a couple of other things just to call out the options that are available. So on here, there's a few other things here. Viewing the XML, most folks don't want to do this. It's just a more complex way of debugging.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We often ask folks to do this if we're trying to help them debug a problem with code first.
Gotcha.
We can view the SQL to create the database. Now, with migrations, this is a little obsolete now, but it's still there if you need it.
Right.
Another way to get a script to give to your DBA.
Cool.
Folks that have really, really large models, there's a way you can do some optimization. So when we hit a model and we want to run a query, we have to do some calculations to work out what the SQL looks like to run queries for that model. We have to work out what the SQL looks like to do inserts and updates and all that. Don't do this unless you really need to, but if you're hitting performance issues with a really large model, then generate views will actually pre-calculate some of that so that when your app starts up, you don't have to take on that cost.
Oh, okay. Good.
Then the option to reverse engineer code first is tucked under the project. So I right-click on the project, reverse engineer code first. The code that we generate is actually customizable too.
Hmm.
So you can customize the reverse engineer templates. It'll give you some templates you can edit to change the way the code is generated.
Nice.
So there's a bunch of options there. The reason these aren't part of our designer at the moment these are still super early. Mm-hmm. We're still working through bugs. We're still working out exactly what options we should have. So mm-hmm. we weren't ready to put them in Visual Studio. At some point, this stuff will merge with our tooling.
Fantastic. If you were to do the customized templates, just as a for instance, let's say I do the customized templates and something seems like a good idea at the time, uh-huh. and I tweak it, and then I realize 3 months down the road that I really wish I hadn't done that.
Yep.
Is there a way to reset the default templates again?
Yeah, just right-click, add the code generation templates, or you can just delete them and we'll use the defaults.
Okay, cool. Good enough.
Now, the important thing to remember here is that reverse engineer code first is really designed as a one-time process. Mm-hmm. So I have like a big database. This gets me started. Mm-hmm. Once I've done that, it's code first, I own the code, I should really be editing the classes.
Cool.
Of course, if I make huge changes and I want to blow away and start again, I can re-reverse engineer the code first.
Right. So you could do a reverse engineer against an existing database, get your code first, work with all your scaffolding, build your app, and then theoretically you could use migrations to change based on code first from there on out.
Absolutely.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty
cool. So there's two ways to do that. One, and this is probably the most common way, so I have a database. It's probably already deployed somewhere. I can, reverse engineer code first. I get all the code. I can then use migrations, but I can tell migrations that the starting point for this is really what the database looked like the first time I reverse engineered.
Okay.
So I don't want migrations to care about all those tables that were there.
Okay.
I just want it to be able to incrementally change it. Nice. You can, if you wanted to, actually tell migrations to care about all those tables that were there.
Okay.
And then if you could point to an empty database and tell it to create, and it would actually create all those tables plus the changes you made. So
cool. You
have some options there.
Awesome. Another random question. Is there a way to tie in migrations other than probably like low-level command line execution? Is there a way to tie this in as like a MS build task?
Yes.
Like
so
run this as a CI?
So kind of thing? Everything we've shown here is very, very thin wrap over the top of public APIs.
Okay.
So if you want to write code to do it, you can. The other thing we actually drop on disk is this thing called migrate.exe. Hmm. So I'll just open up Solution Explorer, Windows Explorer. Go into packages, we'll find the entity framework. We go and look in tools, there's a migrate.exe. This allows you to basically run the update database command from the command line,
Okay. Which
means you can put it as a post build step, you can call it from anywhere.
Nice, that's wonderful. I'll be trying that later today.
Cool.
That's awesome.
So this is the place to come if you want to know anything about entity framework. So we've done a bit of work to tidy this up, we're doing a lot more work to tidy the site up at the moment too. But there's three main sections, some instructions on how to get EF and use it, mm-hmm. a whole bunch of tutorials and stuff on how to use EF, and then a section that explains the best way to get help. So you're using any framework, you've looked at the tutorials, you've got some questions, here's how to get help on that.
Nice. Fantastic. That's wonderful. So it's msdn.wackshell.com/data.ef.
Yeah. If you want to shorten it up a bit, you can just do msdn.com/whack data/whack EF.
Okay,
that'll get
cool.
you there.
Awesome. And this obviously just bounces you to whatever language your browser says.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's fantastic. And I guess the get, it's pretty easy. You just use NuGet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
So we use the command line in NuGet. There is a right-click experience as well if you want to use a UI.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Migrations at the moment is just the command line. We thought we'd probably have to deliver a tooling, kind of UI tooling as well, but really we haven't heard anyone ask for it. So it looks at the moment like we'll be sticking with command line. We might add some tooling pretty windows later in as well.
Okay. Well, do you have anything else you want to show us? This is a really awesome introduction into how to use EF in an MVC application. I know I don't have any questions on how to use it except for when do I get to go sit down and try.
You can try it now. Everything I show is public. So.
Awesome. Yeah. So you can go ahead and get started today using EF5. I presume you can get just using the pre-flag.
Yep.
Any theory on the release date, the final?
It's looking like at the moment, because we're integrated so much into different areas in Visual Studio, mm-hmm. we'll probably release alongside the release of Visual Studio 11.
Okay. But you do have a go live for it, so you can go ahead
Absolutely.
And use it now and then deploy your apps. And
yep. And the changes we're working on, really, we're just doing bug fixes at the mm-hmm. moment. Mm-hmm. The reason we want to hold off is as we do the final testing of things like MVC, we want to make sure any bugs we find there get fixed in the final release as well.
Got you. Do you have a user voice? For EF?
We do, yep. Okay. You can go ef.mswish.net, and that'll take you to our user voice site.
ef.mswish.net.
Yep.
Okay, awesome. Well, thanks a lot for your time, and thank you for your time. I hope you guys go out and give EF a shot now.
Thank you.